Okay, now I think in answering many of these questions, I may have jumped to quite a few points without adequately covering the necessary ground in between. And so I would like to back up a bit and try to fill in the gaps. We started with the tremendous importance of money in making possible a modern economic system dependent on the division of labor. There's an important related aspect of that, that when we have money and money prices for virtually everything, we can have economic calculations and comparisons. This is point two under A. We compare the value of the output with the sum of the prices of the means of producing the output, and we know whether we're operating at a profit or a loss. That's the key considerations. It tells us, should we be doing what we're doing or stop? The existence of money and money prices permits economic calculations for using different methods of production. You know, which is the lower cost method on the basis of the different prices of following the different methods. We can compare the profitability of different products, the profitability of investing in different industries, compare one occupation with another. And on the basis of that information, we know what to do. Other things being equal, we always want to do what will enable us to earn more and pay less. And that's an objective procedure in a monetary economy, because to the extent we succeed in doing that, we have greater monetary means. We can obtain more wealth in exchange. Now, later after the midterm, we'll spend time on the relationship between money-making and the concept of productive activity. That's another very important issue. But what I want to do now is fill in the gaps in connection with the relationship between the quantity of money and the volume of spending in the economic system. And this comes under the heading, the quantity theory of money. The gist of the quantity theory of money is that the amount of money spent in the economic system depends primarily on the amount of money that exists. The quantity of money being spent in the economy depends primarily on the amount of money that exists. Now, there are different measures of the amount of money being spent. The most popular is GDP, gross domestic product. That's currently running, I think, at an annual rate of $11.7 trillion or something like that. Why is it $11.7 trillion now? Not all that many years ago, it was $5 trillion. Not all that many years before that, it was $1 trillion. What keeps this number rising year after year, pretty much? Well, the basic explanation is that the quantity of money is increasing. The larger the quantity of money, the greater is the volume of spending. And I have here two formulas connected with this. The formulas of M times V equals V. M represents the quantity of money. V is the velocity of circulation of money. That simply means the number of times in a year the average unit of the money supply is spent. The number of times in a year the average unit of the money supply is spent, that's velocity. And D is the amount of spending, demand, in the sense of the amount of spending. So the quantity of money times the velocity of circulation equals aggregate demand, understood as the aggregate amount of spending. And as I say, GDP is the most popular measure, though by no means not the only measure of aggregate demand. And we can put some meat on this formula. Here's our formula, M times V equals D. M is the money supply in trillions of dollars. V is velocity. D is demand, which
for the time being, you can understand there's GDP in trillions of dollars. And here we are, as of the present, we have a money supply of approximately 2.7 trillion. Where did I get the 2.7 trillion? Well, that would take us back to what we started looking at, M1 plus sweeps, plus yet a further component, which hopefully we'll say a little bit about. And this money supply, the average unit of it, was spent 4.3 times in the current year, giving us a GDP of $11.7 trillion. 4.3 times 2.7 should work out to 11.7. So there's $2.7 trillion being spent on an average 4.3 times in a year in a way that counts in GDP, and that's where we get 11.7 trillion GDP. Next year, the money supply will almost certainly be somewhat larger, and the GDP will also be larger. Yes, Mr. Mitchell.
In your book, you've got a velocity, and it fluctuates pretty greatly from, I don't know, somewhere around zero to close to seven almost.
Right.
And it seems to coincide with kind of high points or kind of recessionary or type of time. Does that follow here? So next year, the velocity of money, if you see that go to from 4.3 to 4.6, would that indicate that we're getting more recessionary or less recessionary?
It would indicate that we're getting more inflationary, I think. A major, not the only, but a very major determinant of velocity is the rate of increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending. The more rapidly the quantity of money and volume of spending grow, other things being equal, the higher will tend to be velocity. The less rapidly they grow, the lower will tend to be velocity, for reasons which I hope to explain systematically, but probably not till next week. Yes?
Wouldn't you find that really better than surplus? You combine the CPU with the rate of velocity and quantity of money. It seems like there's two independent actions. We'll talk about the Federal Reserve considering money at a moment's notice.
Yeah.
And you're also talking about the velocity being what people are spending.
No, velocity is not the amount that people are spending. Velocity is the average number of times a unit of the money supply is spent in a way that counts in the aggregate we're concerned with. So here's the quantity of money. This is what the Federal Reserve directly or indirectly controls. And here's velocity, which, for reasons to be explained, will tend to be the higher the more rapid is the increase in the quantity of money, and will tend to be the lower the less rapid. And GDP is a reflection of the two. But velocity is not really, velocity does not have the same status as the quantity of money. Velocity isn't an independent determinant. It depends mainly, as I'll try to show, on the rate of increase and prospects of a rate of increase in the quantity of money. Yes, Mr. Wilson.
How are you going to report the opener and actually grab the savings and greater than double gain? However, as a look at the standard of GDP, though, it's not as bad as it could be. Now, the standard of GDP, you know, it isn't the amount of money that they came in here.
Yeah.
And the velocity, because they can kind of, I guess, control that rate or percentage that the deficit is affected by the money, right?
Does the rate of increase in the quantity of money and GDP have an impact on the significance of the deficit? Yes, it does. You see, many people look at the deficit, and each year there's a deficit, the national debt is that much higher, and many people have been concerned that the government may be faced with bankruptcy. This is a major concern, I think, of Ross Perot when he ran for president some years ago. Now, there are some serious implications of the deficit,
But the federal government going bankrupt is really not one of them, because so long as the debt is payable in dollars, they can manufacture more dollars. And as your question indicates, in raising GDP, it indirectly raises next year's tax revenues, too. So the deficit is not significant from the point of view of whether or not the government will go bankrupt. It won't go bankrupt so long as the money it owes is payable in its own currency. But that doesn't mean it's not a serious problem, because what keeps happening to the buying power of the money? It keeps going down. So it's very doubtful that the government could repay a debt if it were translated into the same buying power that prevailed when the money was lent to the government. All right, let me turn to this closely related formula where I tried to connect prices to the quantity of money. Here we have a formula, P equals D over S, and D is the same demand that we just had up here. And that P is the aggregate spending, however we count it. And the price level, the general consumer price level, which is what P represents, is equal to the demand for consumers' goods in the sense of the amount of money spent to buy them divided by the supply of consumers' goods produced and sold. For the moment, ignore these numbers. The general consumer price level is equal to the amount of money spent to buy consumers' goods. And as a rough approximation, you can think of GDP as representing that. That essentially is the amount of money spent to buy consumers' goods. And if you divide that by the supply of consumers' goods produced and sold, you have the weighted average level of prices at which the goods are sold. Let me try to flesh this out a bit more. Down in the bookstore on the second floor, they sell these bottles of water. Now, suppose I ask you the question, calculate the average price at which such a bottle was sold in the bookstore over the last 1 week. What information would you need? Yes? The money taken in exchange for the water, and the number sold. So if, for example, we knew that $100 was taken in exchange for the water, and they happen to sell 100 bottles for that $100, then we know the average price at which a bottle of water was sold was $1. And obviously, the same formula would apply to any other good. New Hondas at Ray Flatabo or wherever, new shoes at Florsheim's or wherever. It easily applies to any one good. The average price at which any one good is sold in any location for any period of time. Now, all we need is to some methods whereby we can look not only at bottles of water, but also at automobiles and houses and suits of clothes, pairs of shoes, loaves of bread. We want to conceive the total output of the economy, or the total supply of consumers' goods produced and sold. We need to conceive of that in terms of some homogeneous unit. Now, we can have wide disagreement about precisely how we should do this, but I think in one way or another, we all do it in connection with various things. I suppose I would ask you, do you think the total output of the American economy today in 2004 is much larger than it was in 1904? I think there's no doubt about it, but there are some goods, probably, that were produced in 1904 that we're not producing at all today. There are many other goods that we're producing today that weren't produced at all in 1904. And the goods that are in common between the two periods, for the most part, there's probably been important qualitative changes. And wherever, even putting aside the qualitative changes, the goods that are produced in both points of time have not changed in a uniform multiple. So there'd be some goods that were producing 120 times more, others that were producing 3 times more, and everything in between. Nevertheless, we're able to say that we certainly are producing substantially more today than then. We would also, I think, have no doubt about saying the United States produces very substantially more than Canada, even though there are some things they produce there that we may not produce at all, and vice versa. And we certainly don't produce a uniform multiple of each thing that is produced in the two countries. And yet, one way or another, we're capable of saying that we produce more. Well, all we're attempting to do here is try to put to think of it in some terms of some definite amount, whatever that definite amount might actually be. It has to be something by some standard. And if it is something of some definite magnitude, if we can say the supply of consumer goods produced and sold in total is such and so much in 1 year, and in the next year it's more or less, well, we can conceive of the prices at which the goods are sold as formed by the ratio of how much is spent to how much is received in exchange. So, however we quantify the output, suppose I were to tell you that, and we would agree, that the output of the American economy today, suppose we took it as 10 times the output of 1904. I'm sure you could argue that it's a lot more than 10 times, but let's say it were 10 times. What would be mathematically necessary to explain how it could be that over the same interval of time, the average of prices has also increased by a factor of 10? Well, what would be implied about the amount of spending? How much would you have to spend to buy 10 times the output, and yet you have to pay 10 times the price for the average unit of the output? How much? Well, we're buying 10 times more, but at 10 times the prices. Well, here we are. Suppose you try to put numbers in here. So I'm telling you, the general consumer price level is up by a factor of 10. And we say, we agree, the supply of consumer goods produced and sold is also up by a factor of 10. What would have to explain how 10 times the volume of goods would have 10 times the average price? Yeah. What would have had to happen to the demand? Yeah. It would have to be 100 times more. See, if we have 100 times as much spent to buy 10 times as much, well, what's 100 divided by 10? 10. So it takes 100 times the spending for 10 times the goods to make the prices 10 times higher. Now, suppose the volume of spending had not increased by a factor of 100. Suppose the volume of spending had increased by a factor of 12. And the quantity of goods produced and sold had increased by a factor of 10. Pardon me? Well, what would be in the numerator? What would we multiply demand for consumer goods by?
12.
We'd multiply by 12. And we'd multiply the, let's do it. And this would be times 10. Well, putting in the X throws the program off. But what is 12 divided by 10? 1.2. So prices, instead of being 10 times as high, would only be 20% as high. What if over the same interval of time, while the production and supply of goods had gone up by a factor of 10, the volume of spending had gone up by a factor of only 5. Here, if this is up by a factor of 5, what would be implied about the price level?
Well,
What if I told you at some future time $500 is spent in a week to buy 1,000 bottles of water in the bookstore? What's implied about the average price? It's gone down by half. So what's happening for the price level is the outcome of the relationship between the volume of spending in the economy and the quantity of goods produced and sold. Now, we know that practically every year the quantity of goods produced and sold is going up, and at the same time the volumes, the price level is going up. So what explains the rise in prices? The increase in the volume of spending, the rise in aggregate demand. Prices have been rising in the United States because the volume of spending has been growing at a faster rate than the volume of production and quantity sold. Every year there's some increase, almost every year, there's some increase in the production and supply of goods, but in almost every year there is a significantly greater increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending. Can you agree that, does anyone have a problem with seeing why the rise in the price level reflects the increase in money and spending outstripping the increase in production and supply? Do you think it would be conceivable if the volume of spending did not outstrip the increase in production and supply, would the price level possibly rise? Pardon me? Well, what would be needed for the price level to go down? Well, we had an example of the price level declining just with the bottles of water. If the volume of production increased more than the volume of spending, then prices would go down. As a matter of fact, it may be surprising to learn that exactly that is what happened in the 19th century. You know, the 19th century was a period of a tremendous increase in production. At the beginning of the 19th century, there were no railroads, no steamships, no telegraphs, hardly any steam engines. They were little more than experimental. So production was really pretty small. Population was a fraction at the beginning of the 19th century compared to what it was at the end. Like in the United States, the population was about 5 million in 1800, and it was close to 100 million in 1900. In Britain, I think the population was about 8 million in 1800 and was over 40 million in 1900. And this was the century in which the railroads were built, the steel industry was developed, ocean-going steel ships were constructed, the telephone and telegraph were introduced, electricity got started, major manufacturing began. So there was a huge increase in production. And at the end of the century, it is estimated the prices on an average were on the order of half of what they had been at the beginning of the century. Now, there had to be a tremendous increase in spending over the 19th century, but it was outstripped by an even greater increase in production and supply. Can anyone think of any factor that we've been dealing with on and off that could explain the very significant fall in prices in the 19th century and their more profound rise in the 20th century? Well, the Industrial Revolution actually started in the late 18th century, and you could say it was continuing perhaps through the 19th century, and it's further continued now up to the present time.
Automation?
the automation machinery that's increasing the production and supply of things, and how do increases in production and supply operate on prices, other things being equal? They make prices go down. Yes, Mr. Rutherford? More debt. If that would make prices go up? Think of that. What is the amount of money that can be borrowed depend on? On the amount of money that exists. If you have an economy with a limited money supply, well, that will operate to limit how much money can be lent and borrowed. What would be the essential thing? The money supply or the derivative, the amount of borrowing? I think the essential answer is a major difference in the rate of growth in the volume of spending. But the volume of spending itself depends on the quantity of money. Where you have a limited increase in the volume of spending, that's because there's a limited increase in the quantity of money. Where you have a vast increase in spending, it's because the foundation is there in terms of a vast increase in the quantity of money. Well, what's the major difference with respect to money between the 19th century and the 20th century in the United States, Mr. Foster? Okay, and Mr. Foster, I think it's implying that the increase in population may be the source of an increase in spending. Well, now let's look at that. If you have an increase in population, more people want more things. Look like you have an answer. What is your name, sir?
Chris Corner.
Chris Corner. Okay, Mr. Corner.
No longer being on the gold standard, it's more money.
I would say that's the real answer, that in the 19th century, the country was on the gold standard. That very sharply limited the rate of increase in the quantity of money, only to the extent that new and additional gold could be mined, and also silver, too, could the quantity of money grow and the volume of spending. For most of the 20th century, there has been no such constraint, and even while there still was such a constraint, it was being weakened. Now, I think that is the fundamental. If we didn't have the growth in money, it's true there'd be more people around if we have population growth, and they'd like more collectively, but how do people have to get the money to spend? They need to produce, they need to get a job, right? Now, if you have more people and they're entering the labor market to find a job, what is the effect of more workers on wage rates? It will operate to decrease wage rates. Now, if we have some increase in the quantity of money, to take some hypothetical numbers, suppose over the 19th century, the volume of production increased by 10 and the quantity of money increased by 5. That would explain prices falling in half. If the population did not increase that rapidly, so the population really doubled. Assume that to go with our other assumptions. Suppose we have five times the volume of spending, five times the total wages paid in the economy, two times the number of workers competing for jobs. What would be the effect on the average money wage? Five times the total wages paid, two times the workers competing for jobs.
Higher.
How much higher? Five over two, 2.5, right? Okay, now if there's five times the spending and 10 times the output, prices are half, right? Okay, and if money wages are 2.5 and prices are half, what does that imply about how much the average worker can buy? Five times more. you're earning 2.5, 5.5, so 5 times the real wage. See, the increase in the supply of workers limits the rise in wages. There's 5 times more spending, but that won't raise wages 5 times. If there's twice the number of workers, it raises wages 2.5 times. But if there's 10 times the output, 5 times the spending still goes with prices being half. Yes, Mr. Richard.
Would the advent of the social welfare system in the 20th century be that?
Would the social welfare system increase prices?
In the New Deal and everything after that?
It's possible it could have a limited effect. Imagine that you suddenly establish a large-scale welfare system, and some significant number of people feel, oh, now they don't need to work, they'll go on welfare. Okay, if everything else were equal, if the total population is the same, the quantity of money and the volume of spending are the same, but now we have some percentage of the people withdrawing from the labor market, what would that do to the number of people working and producing? It would reduce it. Okay, wage rates would go up, but also, if there are fewer people working, and if the output per worker were unchanged, what would it be doing to the production and supply of consumers' goods? That would go down, so prices would be going up too. And who would be paying the bulk of the costs for this welfare? The taxpayers, many of whom are workers. So their wages go up, but out of the higher wages, they're paying taxes, and prices rise corresponding to the higher wages that they have. So they would have a loss. Now, this would account for a limited rise in prices, but do you think it could account for any very sustained, repeated, cumulatively substantial rise? You see, in order to explain prices rising because fewer people were working, how many fewer people would have to work in order for prices to double? You have to have half the people working, adding the production, that would double prices. But if even if that happened, which I don't think it could ever get that far, but even if such a thing happened, suppose that you had scientific and technological progress still going on, so the output of the half that were working was increasing. So you might have half the people working, but if the half who worked were producing twice as much on average each, then what happens to prices? They'd be the same. Instead of doubling, they'd be the same. And the effects of this sort of thing that reduces production and supply, it would be to make prices higher than they otherwise would have been, but it's almost impossible to take it account for a progressive nature.
I remember in Germany, there was a problem there because of the flexible labor market.
Yeah.
They had a pretty strong, most of Europe had a strong social welfare system.
Yeah.
Is that the reason why prices seem to be higher? Well, American going to Germany?
I would say that it's probably a factor for prices being higher to the extent they have the value-added tax. I know their tax system explains the sharply higher price of gasoline, retail gasoline in Europe, but it would not explain any disparity in the annual rates at which prices rise. I would say the real wages, the standard of living in the United States is higher than in Western Europe, and I believe it's probably because we have a higher output per worker. The higher output per worker gives a more favorable relationship between wage rates and prices. It makes prices lower relative to wages. Yes, Mr. Rutherford.
But doesn't that higher output per worker have a direct relationship back to both the social programs in the sense that employees know they're working to put a significantly more greater amount of money in
Yeah, that would all enter. You see, just consider if you had two economies with everything being equal, except in one, the average worker works 50 weeks a year, and the other he works 48 weeks a year. In one, in the weeks in which he does work, he's working 40 hours a week, and the other, in the weeks in which he does work, he's working 35 hours a week. What would be implied about production in these two economies, all other things being equal? Production would be higher in the economy in which people work more, and to the extent the social welfare policies induce people to work less or compel them to work less, that would result in less production and higher prices. And even though the reduction in hours worked, reducing the supply of labor performed, can raise nominal wage rates, it also raises prices correspondingly, and out of the higher nominal wages, you're paying higher taxes. So the net balance is you're just stuck with higher prices. Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Production efficiency might have some contributions to the price or the lower high or the fluctuation of the price.
Yeah, these improvements in efficiency. Well, what do you guys think the effect of improvements in efficiency is on prices? See, with greater efficiency, well, the first thing that's cut is the unit cost. And a simple way to look at it, this is not a 100% perfect method, but the overwhelming element of cost is labor cost. And now, when costs are cut, almost always it will mean lower labor costs. Even when you switch from a more expensive to a less expensive material, say. Suppose the cost cut to you appears as you're now using a less expensive material. Well, what would be the main element explaining why one material is less expensive than another? But it probably takes less labor to produce. Now, to the extent we succeed in producing things with less labor, where does the labor that we no longer need to produce those given things, but where will that go? It will produce more of other things or larger quantities of those things. So as you save labor, that amounts to increasing production. Think about this for a moment, and I think we dealt with this somewhat last week. We've had tremendous improvements in efficiency over the last 200 years. The average unit of labor, it probably takes a small fraction of the labor today to produce practically anything that it used to take. Now, do these labor-saving improvements result in unemployment on a long-term economy-wide basis? We've cut the quantity of labor required to produce practically everything by a major multiple. The unemployment rate is not significantly different. What has the saving of unit labor shown up as? Yeah, if we produce the average good with 1/100th the labor today, well, that explains why we're producing 100 times more per capita. And what does that do to prices, other things being equal? It operates to reduce them correspondingly. Prices would have fallen incredibly. Why have prices risen instead of falling, even though we've had this tremendous rise in production? Because there's still more rapid increase in the quantity of money. And what is it that allows the increase in the quantity of money, and thus the volume of spending, so regularly and consistently to outstrip the increase in production and supply? What is it about the monetary unit that permits this? Well, there's no gold standard. The monetary unit that we have is something that has virtually zero cost to produce, and nothing limits the quantity. So we shouldn't be surprised that its value keeps declining. Now, this is a very unfair race. So what underlies the increase in production and supply? What factors underlie the increase in production and supply, above all, per capita? Well, do you mean the amount of money spent? Well, now there's labor, well, there's the amount of labor, but that wouldn't relate so much on a per capita basis. Why is it that we produce so much more per capita today than 100 years ago and 200 years ago? Greater efficiency, technological progress, science and invention, saving and investment. We have new processes developed, new products, new types of capital goods that implement the technological advances. And why do we have that? Who is responsible for that? Is that something that just happens? Private enterprise and individual businessmen and capitalists are looking to make a profit. The basic way that you make a profit, if you don't have the legislature bribes and in your pocket, the way you have to make a profit in a free economy is you have to produce improved products or produce existing products more efficiently. That's the basic way. And as we produce any given product more efficiently, that releases the labor to produce more either of that product or of other products. And this is the driving force of the increase in production and supply. Now, there are lots of people. I'm sure every successful firm has some nucleus of people. Maybe you're part of them at the firms you're working at. And we're literally staying up late at night thinking about how they could improve what their company is doing. And they're devoting long, hard hours to improving the products and methods of production. And these people are trying as hard as they can throughout the year. Maybe collectively, on an average, they might succeed in increasing the supply of things 3-4% at most. That would be a very good number today. So that's the product of their best efforts, their best, most conscientious efforts. How easy is it to increase the quantity of irredeemable paper money at a more rapid rate? There's no problem at all. See, there's a very unequal race. On the one side, the scientists, inventors, the businessmen and capitalists, with their best efforts, working as hard and as conscientiously as they can, in a good year, they can increase the production and supply of things 3-4%. On the other side, the expansion in the quantity of irredeemable paper money, without any difficulty, can proceed at 6, 8, 10%, or even much more. So what outcome would you expect? The prices should be rising. It would be astonishing if you keep all of this in mind, that prices would not keep rising. Yes, Mr. Wright.
I don't want to digress, but what do you think if you have the gold standard, as a corner person, the time value of money is going to be irrelevant? If it would be an inflation, you think you have an inflation, you think you gain value or lose value, would that formula then be erroneous?
The time value of money?
For example, future value.
Well, pardon me?
Yeah,
there would still be a time value of money, but what would be true is the time, the rate of return that they would require would be lower. See, the more rapid expansion in the quantity of money means systematically that later on, when it's time to sell, there's more money out there than when you spent the money to bring in the sales. See, just think, suppose you constructed a factory in 1980. Okay, and that factory will be producing, let's say, till 2020. All right, now, if the quantity of money and volume of spending between 1980 and 2020 are increasing at one rate, that means that there'll be some effect, will likely be some effect on your sales revenues. If the quantity of money and volume of spending are increasing at a more rapid rate over that period, what should be the effect on your sales revenues from year to year? Should they tend to be larger from year to year? Okay, what does that imply about the spread between the cash flow that you're taking in each year compared with the fraction of your initial outlay? Pardon me? If you have greater cash flow, So if in 1980 you spent $1 million on a piece of plant for the 40-year life, you can think of that as there's 40 parcels of $25,000 each. 40 times 25,000 is a million. And each of those 25,000 will be paired against some future revenue. Now, if the flow of revenue is growing modestly, because the quantity of money and volume of spending are growing modestly, well then, the spread will be relatively modest. The more rapidly money and spending grow, what's happening to the size of that spread? It's larger, so that introduces a systematic rise in the rate of return in the time value of money, as it were. At the same time, what is it doing to prices? It's raising prices, so you have higher nominal profits, higher nominal interest, but it doesn't mean that you're really any better off. Because what you're gaining in higher profit, you're losing back in higher prices, and you very well may not be able to replace the assets you bought, but that's a subject for the end of the term. Yes, Mr. Whitechuck.
Well, the irony is on top of all of that, you just said that monopolies are illegal. So the monopoly, if you have a monopoly, right, you could keep the system essentially because you have, like, you know, inelastic demand, ideally, and then, you know, then it doesn't matter how much money they're making because you have, like, you know, people need to buy your product or service, your good or service.
Yeah. I'm not quite sure what your point is, but...
Well, that way, it wouldn't matter, like, how much money they were producing, because people would still demand your products. But...
Yeah, but you see, it does relate to what you're thinking of as monopolies. Everyone who holds a copyright has what you can think of as a legal monopoly. So the publisher of every copyrighted book legally can ask any price he wants, or a piece of music, or whatever. One has to be present for people in such a protected position to raise their prices from year to year. What has to happen to the demand? It has to be rising. Now you see, suppose there's something that people may have a desperate need for, or whatever. Why wouldn't you just ask that best price immediately? What are you waiting for? Well, if you're waiting for increase in demand. Okay, but then that brings us to the question, what underlies any kind of systematic increase in demand? Well, you see, customer preference. You could have an increase in the demand for any given product if the customers decide, well, now they like your product rather than other products. That could enable you to raise your price, perhaps. But what does that imply about the demand for those other products? That's decreased, right? Now, what would be the effect of that on the prices of these other products? They would tend to go down. Now, if what we're observing is that you're able to raise your prices every year, and there's no great pressure for anyone to lower his prices, in fact, almost everybody is raising his prices, what has to be the explanation? The overall demand, the aggregate demand is rising. That enables prices to go up every year. You see, even protected legal monopolists, what's true about them is they want to ask a higher price than would prevail under open competition, but that doesn't mean that they want to ask a continually rising price. They would want to ask their best price as soon as possible, and then you have to ask, why don't they ask a still higher price? What limits the price that even a protected legal monopolist asks? And it comes to a point when the quantity sold will fall off too sharply, so that's as high as you can go. Now, what has to happen to enable you to raise that price the next year? The demand has to grow. The demand has to grow. Now, the demand might grow because other prices are falling. Now, if other prices falling is the foundation for the rise in demand for what you have, because it gives people more disposable income, well, that's not a problem of systematically rising prices. If other prices are not falling and the demand for your product is rising, If the total aggregate demand is rising, then the explanation is an increase in the quantity of money. Yes, Mr. Carey.
I have a question. When production increases because of greater efficiency,
yes,
you're for price saving. I think you also made a point that workforce is going to have a major impact on the rate of some of the.
Yeah.
So that brings up the argument around houses.
The outsourcing argument.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right to say that it casts doubt on the fear of outsourcing, because it may be suggesting how would this differ from importing a machine from one of these places and producing at a fraction of the cost that way. But I think there's another way to look at this problem. Suppose we have a situation, someone has been making $100,000 doing something each year, and now that same job is realized can be performed at $20,000 if it's sourced out to India. All right, now, this person who had been earning $100,000, he's not suddenly going to work for $20,000, right? He won't have a job at $100,000, but he'll have some other kind of job, maybe at $50,000 or $60,000. His earnings will not fall to the same degree as the reduction in cost. Right now, this may be a very bad situation for this person, but his earnings have sharply fallen, and the improvement in what he buys is very, very tiny, because it's just as one small item. But what is the effect on the standard of living of all the other wage earners in the economy of this particular act of outsourcing? That goes up. Right, now, let's try to generalize it. Let's imagine that in the whole economy, there are 100 different jobs, only 100 different jobs. And assume that initially, everyone is earning, we'll say, $100,000. And now, pretty much everybody's job could be outsourced for $10,000. But there are still other jobs that will appear that people can do for $50,000. What would be implied about the prices of the things we were getting? You see, we could be competitive in meeting the competition of people who can do the job at $10,000 if we were willing to take an income of $10,000. Well, we don't have to. There's still much, much better jobs than that available. What is the effect on the cost of what we'd be buying if we have widespread outsourcing? Suppose all the workers are getting half the money income, but the prices of the things they're buying are 10% of what they used to be. Pardon me?
They're
better off in real terms. There'd be a substantial improvement because while their earnings might have fallen, they would not fall to the extent that costs are cut and prices reduced.
They could have more money now to spend on other things.
Yeah, that would be the point. There would be more things available to people. If all of the things, or so many of the things that we now do, could be done more cheaply outside the country, and we let that happen, well, then all of those things are cheaper. All of those things will be cheaper. But the people who used to do them will have will find other jobs. And even if the wage level were to fall somewhat, the implication is that prices would fall even further. Yes, Mr. Corman.
So long as you don't have a mortgage, countrywide, it's not there.
That's a good consideration. If there were a substantial fall in wage rates, that would be difficult for people who have significant debts. That much is true. Yes, in the back, Mr.
Rosenwald. Okay, in line with what Chris was thinking about it, I think the outsourcing has to reach a certain level of penetration in the market to substantially drop prices so that the end is certainly affected by that dollar price.
Well,
if there's something in the end of the business drop the price, it might not affect me, it might not affect Chris, it might not affect the majority of the people out there.
Right.
So a number of our companies here have to buy into this outsourcing. So it does have a good effect
on
the general public.
Well, if the only problem were Landon, let's say that you're saying it's not a big effect on the general public, would be a problem for Landon, but to the extent there is an effect on the rest of the population, what is it? If it's just Landon's industry.
Very small.
Well, it might be small, but is it negative or positive for the rest of the population? Wouldn't it have to be positive? Because here we are, we have a small minority of people doing the particular type of work in question, and the great majority are consumers, directly or indirectly, of that work. So if there's something that makes things more difficult for a limited class of producers, but there's cheapening the product they produce, while it might, in some cases, be hard on the producers, it's got to benefit the consumers. But let me say further to address Mr. Corman's observation. In practice, as time is going on, what do you think is happening to the demand for labor and wage rates? It's increasing, so the outsourcing might cut down on the rate of increase. So it would actually be unlikely that we would have generalized substantial declines in nominal wage rates. What it would mean is that prices, if they don't fall, at least would be rising significantly less than they otherwise would have been, and the relationship between the rise in prices and the rise in wages would be improved. Yes, Mr. Foster.
I don't know exactly how long we're talking about, but we're talking about the long term. But we take any outsourcing as an example. Landon and I work for the same company.
Yeah.
And when we first started outsourcing, as a dedicated agency, if a computer programmer has $10,000 and we look at them as a commodity, it is most definitely limited. So if we take, you know, we employ 5,000, you know, computer programmers at $10,000 at some point in time, where other companies start coming in outsourcing, their wages are going to start going up. Now, although ours have lower because we have to go to different industries, at some point in time, we're going to have to balance
that. Yes, that's perfectly true. That's a very good observation. Since there's a limited number of these people to do the outsourcing jobs, as there's more demand to take advantage of it, it raises their wages, and as there's less demand for all workers of the same kind, and their wages fall, there's an equilibrium achieved, and the competitive disadvantage comes to an end. So it's not the case that it goes on forever without any limit. Yes, Mr. Coleman.
So we're going for a little bit for quite a while. 3.5 people in India, and specifically in software, but not in software.
Mm-hmm.
And I compete against Google programs, but it's also China and Russia are now doing the same thing.
Right.
There's years worth of pent-up labor over there.
Mm-hmm. So there'll be some fields, perhaps, that we won't be able to perform on any great basis for a while. But I would think, in the nature of the case, see, here you are, you mentioned India has over 1 billion people, and China even more than India. Now, just think what must be the effect, and in that population, we're basically as intelligent as we are, and if they get integrated into the world economy, what do you think is going to be the effect on the amount of progress that is made and on the ability to produce? It's got to mean a general improvement. if you have more intelligent people working in the division of labor, there's got to be more and better products, which would be an enormous force for the good over this century. Yes, Mr. Weatherford.
On top of, quote unquote, India or China or Russia getting our job, is it equally likely that we will be selling them goods and let's say anything overseas that might back to America? If their wage increase, their demand for consumer goods will increase, and their home company, country, support their own demand. It's more likely that we are going to provide.
I would think the net outcome of this would be that there'll be a change in the pattern of specialization. There'll be some things that are done more predominantly in some of these foreign countries, and then there'll be other things that will be concerned more with producing for them. That's always the effect. Yes, Mr. Morris.
As we create more of these jobs and outsourcing of these other countries, but we're also creating a new type of society in these countries too, where you usually have the very poor and the very rich. But now, because of the outsourcing, you are creating that middle class in countries that never had middle class. And then, on turn, what Bob was talking about, it creates more demand for what we're producing or what other countries in the world are producing.
Yeah, I would think that is what we should expect to be the answer.
And then, one last part for you. Also, the people that lost their jobs for the outsourcing, they're also forced to go back and maybe increase their education levels to become more valuable in higher positions in the economy.
I think that's true also. And notice we have these fears of outsourcing, but how substantial is the unemployment rate? It's not very great by the historical standards. It hasn't. They still have humongous rates, but the fear here is that outsourcing to them will cause us to have the humongous rates. I don't think that's justified. Yes, Ms. Rosenthal.
To follow up, Jerry, you said at some point the train will balance out. How many years in the future do you think it is that the outsourcing continues as it is now?
Well, I'm sure it differs from case to case, and Mr. Foster seems to know more about the programmer's aspect than I do, so maybe he's a better person to ask this particular question.
Well, I'll give you an example in Siberia. A year ago, we could hire additional programmers for $200 a month, per programmer. Right now, the rate is about $2,000 a month because there are so many companies that come there to outsource software engineering, and they're all getting worse and worse.
Yes, Mr. Chung.
Do you see a possibility that as a result of the outsourcing might not drive the price lower in some instances?
With outsourcing not drive prices lower, a more general question subsuming that is, might cost cuts not drive prices lower?
I mean, that's an incentive for a company to, keep the price while their competitor is still, doing a lot of, having a lot of labor to, utilize it within the state, not outsourcing. So,
okay. If you could ask the same question about any cost cutting improvement, must it immediately succeed in correspondingly reducing the price of the product in which the cost reduction occurs? No, it might not. Suppose you have a patented product, let's say, and the company producing it succeeds in cutting the unit cost. And they decide that there isn't any point in cutting the price of the product because there'll be virtually no increase in the quantity demanded. So keep the price of that product unchanged and just make higher profits from the lower cost. That could happen. But if that does happen, the key question is, what do they do with the higher profits? Now, if they save and reinvest these higher profits, or even if they were to pay them as dividends and the recipients of the dividends saved and reinvested the higher profits, then there is more money spent in production somewhere, not in that same industry, but in some other industry. And what will be the effect of that on production in the rest of the economy? It will go up, and if there's no expansion in the quantity of money and volume of spending, or it is whatever it is, it's not getting any greater than it would have been, if we now have more production and supply somewhere, what must be the effect on prices somewhere else compared to what they would have been? Pardon me? Price will be lower elsewhere than they otherwise would have been, and they have to be because there's a bigger production and supply of things somewhere. See, when you succeed in cutting costs at point A, it doesn't mean that right away the price at point A will go down. Maybe you'll have high profits for a time, but if those profits are saved and reinvested, there'll be more production and supply elsewhere in the economy, and there prices and profits will also decline. And now that you have a high profit in this particular industry, and there are somewhat lower profits in other industries, what will be the competitive pressure? At some point, there's going to be more competition in this particular industry. At the most, it may have to wait till the patent comes off. Or other people will be attempting to work around the patent, have an alternative process. There'll be powerful pressure. When costs are cut, sooner or later, prices are going to be cut. And if they're not cut where the cost cuts occur, they're cut pretty quickly somewhere else.
So it seems to me that outsourcing, I think the idea of outsourcing is potentially a good idea for the economy as a whole over a period of time.
Yeah.
It may not be, you know, good for the individual labor earners, but...
Right. It's the same as anything, really. Suppose we have a way, we can produce more of some product using fewer people. The demand for the product is inelastic. The strongest case of that kind, I think, would be the production of table salt. No one is going to buy more table salt because the price is lower. What would happen if we could find a way to produce table salt with half the labor? What would happen to the number of people employed in the production of table salt? It would end up being cut in half. Now, that could be very hard on those people, at least for a time. But what would be the effect of this on the general standard of living? These people will find employment in producing more of something else. We don't want more table salt, but is there anything that we would not want more of? All kinds of things. Now, they would find this employment, it could occur very quickly, provided the extra profits from the making of table salt were saved and invested somewhere. Then that creates more job opportunities. But sooner or later, what will happen to the price of table salt? It'll decline, and when it declines, people are getting the same table salt for half the money, and what do they do with the money they used to spend in buying table salt? They're buying other things. So there's additional demand created elsewhere. So the overall effect is we end up, the same number of people are working, but fewer are working in producing that particular good, in this case table salt, and they're producing more of other things. And they pay less for the table salt, they have the money left over to buy more of other things.
But there is a detrimental effect on the society is that if a lot of companies have rather be outsourcing elsewhere, yeah, and so forth, then you have, suddenly you have a pool of labor that comes forth, and you don't know where those labor could be shipped to elsewhere in a short period. It could be in a somewhat long period until that they find jobs, right? So there's a burden on society that if a lot of companies start outsourcing rapidly, then unemployment rate will go up for a short period until those late, you know, those workers could find a substitute.
Or
until, yeah. So So it's not a good idea, you know, for a short term, but for a long term, the economy or the entire system itself will benefit from.
Did you want to say anything? You are? Okay.
I just want to know what your thoughts are. Do you think as the prices, as the export as the prices are become equilibrium and the rates are kind of come in line, do you think there's jobs come back to the U.S. or whatever country? Do you think there's a cycle or a life cycle for this?
No, you see, I think that as you outsource or whatever, or you substitute imports for domestically produced goods, the outsourcing issue, I think, is no different than importing goods. Imagine you had people, they've been producing things for the domestic market, and now the domestic consumers decide they want to buy imports. So the people who've been producing those goods can no longer produce those goods. Well, they will find alternative jobs, and most likely in the export industry, or the equivalent of them will find jobs in the export industry. The more that we outsource or substitute imports for domestically produced goods, the more we will expand in other areas. It's not going to be the case that when something is done more efficiently, there's no room for the people who used to do a given type of work to work. And I'd have to say, with outsourcing, I don't think that this is something that could become a major short-term economy-wide issue all of a sudden. It can be a local, it can represent localized problems. You could address the question, suppose we had a monetary contraction. Suppose there were a decrease in the volume of spending in the economy, as classically would occur in every recession or depression. What is it that then allows people who are suddenly unemployed, what would allow them, what did, again and again, allow them to find reemployment on terms that were profitable for the employers? Well, in that case, you would need a decline in money wage rates. Money wage rates. Then that reduces cost of production, makes it profitable to sell products at lower prices. Now, I don't think the outsourcing phenomenon is great enough to bring that about, certainly in view of the things that are raising the demand for labor. See, no outsourcing can move the construction industry or the transportation industry or retailing or wholesale. So it applies to a limited number of fields. Yes, Mr. Richard.
Is that why Swedish transportation also noted the union as a stronghold? Because they know their jobs are protected, they can't outsource those jobs to other things?
Well, now, you say, does this explain the automotive unions, their jobs?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, their jobs have been outsourced, only under a different name. You see, what is it that underlies the great growth in imported automobiles? What's the connection between the unionization of the American automobile industry and the import of automobiles? You see, the American automobiles are produced at union wage scales for the most part, with union work rules, and the difficulties of imposing higher quality standards that the unions entail. So how does that connect with the volume of imports? See, the unions have brought about a major outsourcing under another name of automotive jobs. Towards General Motors, you know, there's the phenomenon of the Monday morning car and the Friday afternoon car. Now, the automobile companies are not stupid, and they know what these problems are due to. I'm sure you do. Supposedly, many of the workers come in or either they don't come in Monday mornings because they've had too big a weekend, or they come in a condition not able to do their job right. Okay, why can't the automobile company say, if you don't come in Monday morning ready to work and able to work, don't bother coming in at all? And there are other workers who could easily be trained to do those jobs and who presently don't have such good jobs. Why don't the automobile companies simply do this, and then they would eliminate the Monday morning, Friday afternoon automobiles? They're dealing with the United Automobile Workers Union, and they feel that the cost of a prolonged strike would outweigh the benefits of solving this problem. Now, imagine that we had some of the labor laws repealed, the laws compelling the company to bargain with a labor union. This is something we've had, I think, since 1935. We didn't always have it. And suppose it were abolished, and here there are other workers able to do the job just as well, and you don't have to employ the union workers. Well, what would happen to the wage rates in that unionized industry? What would happen to the efficiency of production and the quality of the products? The wage rates would go down, the efficiency would go up, the quality of the products would go up. What would that do to the size of the domestic industry compared to the imports? The domestic industry would expand. Maybe it could become a net exporter again. And the same, I think, would happen in the steel industry and other industries. So these are areas where we've created an artificial competitive disadvantage. I'm sorry to put you off, Mr. Rutherford.
And continuing the same train of thought, in the short term, wages will drop. The other thing that happened is you mentioned in the long term, because of the increased demand, wages will be increased.
Well, real wages would rise. You see what would happen? There'd be greater employment, we'd reduce unemployment, we'd have lower costs of production, lower prices, and better products. That would be the net effect. And we'll go into this a lot more. Pardon me? Well, the long run, in this case, would probably be on the order of a year or so. It would be, that's relatively short, yeah. Now, we'll go into this in much greater detail, probably in 3 weeks. Or 4 weeks, we'll have a lot to say about the unemployment issue. Let me try to pull things back on the track of the quantity theory of money. I think you can explain why prices are rising from year to year. We have this very simple formula. If you conceive of the price level as formed by the ratio of the amount of money spent to buy things to the quantity of the things purchased, well, that gives you the explanation of rising prices. Here, we have some more hypothetical figures. Suppose, from year to year, the spending to buy goods is increasing 6%, the quantity of goods produced and sold is increasing 3%. Well, what should you expect to happen to prices? What's 1.06? Here we are. I don't know if you can see up on the top here. Plus C30 over D30. Well, here's C30, 1.06, that's the increase in demand. Here's D30, 1.03, the rate of increase in supply. But what happens if we have 1.06 the spending to buy 1.03 the quantity of goods and services? Then prices are up 3%. If we had 10% more spending to buy 3% more goods and services, prices would be up 7%. If we had 2% more spending to buy 3% more goods and services, prices would actually be down 1%. So it's the increase in money and spending that is responsible for the rise in prices. Now, just to tie this down a little bit further, why does the increase in money explain the rise in spending? Well, think back first to the conditions of old Gabby Hayes, who, if you stay up to maybe 4 in the morning, you find a late show. I imagine an old gold prospector who strikes some gold. Think back to the old West, say in this area, 100 50 years ago perhaps, he finds some gold, and gold is the money of the time. Now, in effect, the gold he digs out of the ground will be manufactured into new and additional gold coins, and what will our man be doing with these gold coins? He'll spend them. And what will the recipients of his spending do with those coins? They'll spend them. So these new and additional gold coins underlie a continuous round of spending and respending. What does it imply about the total amount being spent given the foundation of this new and additional money? There's greater spending. Right now, today, we don't have gold as money. We have irredeemable paper, but it's still the same principle. Suppose the Treasury is running short of money. It wants to send out $1,000,000 Social Security checks, and it's short in its checking account. Well, they can easily get this money from their friendly banker, the Federal Reserve System, and all they have to do is they send over $1 billion of Treasury securities that gets locked in the vaults of the Federal Reserve System, and the Federal Reserve can credit the Treasury's checking account by $1 billion. The Treasury now has $1 billion it didn't have. Where did it come from?
Thin air.
Thin air. It was created out of thin air. Someone at the Federal Reserve typed the appropriate keys on a computer keyboard, U.S. Treasury plus $1 billion. Now the Treasury has $1 billion, and $1,000,000 Social Security checks go out to various recipients. Okay, let's imagine that they go into their banks, they cash the checks. The banks, as they're collecting these checks, will be transporting them to the Federal Reserve Bank. The Federal Reserve Bank will be honoring them by issuing the currency from its vaults. Armored cars go to the banks with piles of currency. The Social Security check recipients are walking out each with $1,000. Okay? They'll be spending this money. What will the recipients do? They'll respend it. Now, we can change the example. The recipients will assume have checking accounts, and we can imagine they spend their $1,000 mainly by writing checks. They write checks to various people. What do the recipients of the checks do? They deposit them, and then they can write their own checks. And they have further recipients. So what's common is you have new and additional money, and on its foundation, the amount of money that is spent is correspondingly increased. The new and additional pieces of money are spent and re-spent ad infinitum. The level of spending is higher. So that is basically how the process works. The increase in money leads to the increase in spending. Now, as I said, prices rise because we have a monetary unit whose quantity can so easily be increased more rapidly than the supply of goods and services. It's the unequal race. The businessmen, scientists, and inventors, struggling as hard as they can, may increase production and supply on an average 3% a year, something like that. The quantity of irredeemable fiat money can be increased at rates that easily surpass that. And the result is rising prices. Now, some further significant evidence, a confirmation of the fact that the problem is in the paper money, comes if we examine prices in terms of gold or silver. Now, what I have here on the bottom is a conventional $20 bill. Up on top is an actual size $20 gold coin, known as a double eagle. Now you can buy them from coin dealers. I think there's an outfit in Newport Beach, or used to be, I don't know if they're still in existence, named Monex International. And there are coin dealers here and there in shopping centers. So you can certainly buy them if you're interested.
Yeah.
You could buy a bar of gold too. They have kilogram bars, I guess they have smaller bars. Well, if it's a kilogram, I think that's 32 ounces. A gold coin like this, a $20 gold coin, and contains a shade under an ounce of gold. 20.67, I believe, is the gold content of 1 ounce. Now, what's significant is, in the daily paper, you can find the price for gold bullion. I mean, what is the gold bullion content of a $20 gold piece? What's the gold bullion value of a $20 gold coin? If it contains roughly an ounce of gold, $400. This $20 gold coin, it stamps on its face, notice here, $20. See right here, $20. Okay. Prior to 1933, a $20 gold coin and a $20 bill were interchangeable. Whatever you could buy for the one, you could buy for the other. Just a shade under 1 ounce. Not quite 1 ounce. You see, the price of gold was $20.67 per ounce, so a $20 gold coin would have a physical gold content of 20 divided by 20.67. That's why it was worth $20 rather than $20.67. Okay, so now, today, that same quantity of gold, which prior to 1933 was worth just about $20, today it's worth $400 and tending to rise beyond that. Now think of the implications of this for prices. Not very far from here is one of my top favorite restaurants, Ruth's Chris. And it's a simple matter if you have dinner with, let's say, two couples have dinner. You have a good bottle of wine, maybe a couple of drinks. I'm not supposed to say that here. it wouldn't be difficult with tip to have a bill of $400. Now suppose the law allowed businessmen to accept a gold coin, if they chose, not merely at the face value of the coin, which is $20, and which the law would allow you to accept it as, but at the bullion value of the coin. Okay, then, if the management of Ruth's Chris was willing to be paid that way, and I happen to have a $20 gold coin, how much would my dinner cost in terms of gold dollars? One coin, a $20 gold coin. So here's this $400 dinner, which is quite a few paper dollars, but calculated in the gold coin, it's $20. Yes,
Don't we have additional value based on the rarity of that coin outside of this $400 outside?
The double eagle, unless it's a special issue, has a minimal premium. You could look at the price of gold. There are prices quoted certainly in Barron's and even the New York Times on the commodity page. You can see the price of leading gold coins. The gold coins they're called bullion coins for good reason. Their prices are typically within a couple of percent of the bullion value. So that isn't really an issue. And let me try to pull up the document I had. Now, think of the influence of this on prices. Look at the effect on price calculations. Here we are. If the current price of gold is $400 an ounce, well, a soft drink, which today sells for 75 cents, in terms of gold, the price would be on the order of 4 cents. That's 120. But maybe it's simpler. Well, the expensive meal, I assume now in the table it here is $300. I guess you could change that to what I should have had. Let's make that 400. Okay, that's 20 gold dollars equals 400 paper dollars. Let's say we have a somewhat better car for $40,000. In the gold coin, that would be $2,000. each gold coin counts as $400. So if you have $20 gold, that's 400 multiplied by 10, and you have $4,000 multiplied by 10 more, you have 40,000. And we count that at 100 gold coins. 100 gold coins each at $400. Well, that's $120 gold pieces. That buys the car. So the $40,000 car is 2,000 gold dollars. A $400,000 house would be $20,000. Now, just imagine if gold were had a bigger monetary employment, what would that do to the demand for it, and what would that do to the price of gold? It would be higher, so the price of gold wouldn't be just $400. If it had a significant monetary role, it might be $800, $1,200, and prices expressed in gold would be that much lower. Now, even with the present prices, if merchants could legally discriminate between gold coins compared to paper money, then they could say, yeah, it's true, both units are stamped $20, but we're ready to take the $20 gold unit as the equivalent of $400 in paper. And results would be similar, though less pronounced, with the old silver coins. We had circulating silver coins until as recently as 1965. And the current price of silver, I think, is in the neighborhood of $7 an ounce, which means that an old dime is worth about 50 cents. Now, if merchants could discriminate, and you go shopping, and you see, here we are, some years ago, at one time, something cost a $10 bill or a roll of silver quarters. They were both equivalent. Or at one earlier time, something cost a $20 bill or a $20 gold coin. Now, the price in the paper money has jumped very, very substantially, but the price in the gold or silver coin has not increased nearly so much, or maybe even has fallen. And people started having this day-to-day experience. They're going shopping, and they're seeing, yeah, there's been a big run-up in prices, but the run-up has been overwhelmingly in the paper money, not the gold or silver coin. Well, how do you think that would affect the kind of money that people would want to be paid in? They'd want to have their debts payable to them in gold or silver. They'd want their pensions payable in such things. They'd want to state long-term lease contracts in such in gold and silver. And what do you think that would do to the price of gold and silver? Greatly increase it. And now, if the paper continues to depreciate, while gold and silver held their value or increased their value, how would that affect the demand for paper money? Would people have a need for it? See, that's why I say that in a free economy, the paper money would be replaced by gold and silver in much the same way as in Panama and Ecuador and other places, they want to replace their monies with a dollar. The dollar is better than their monies, but gold is much better even than the dollar. And if we had free choice, I think that's what people would choose. Now, they don't get to make that choice because merchants can't discriminate between the coins. That's against the law. You could pay your check at Ruth's Chris in gold coin if you were prepared to pay 20 $20 gold coins. In other words, pay $8,000 worth of gold, which is why the coins disappear. So this relates to the issue of would the establishment of a gold standard ever be possible? I would say all you would have to do is remove the obstacles. It's not really necessary that the government do very much positive, but if it didn't stand in the way, then you have it come about. That's the different story. You see, the investment value of gold depends on the prospects for inflation. If people believe that inflation will become stronger and maybe accelerate, that will certainly raise gold. But then it's very possible that the government will pull back, pull in its horns again, and cut the ground from under the market. That happened in the early 80s. People thought the United States was about to go the way of Latin America. The prices would start rising by double-digit rates or more every year. And so they were moving heavily into gold. That's why gold got to over $800. But then, to the surprise of many, many people, and myself very much included, they raised short-term interest rates to 22%. The Federal Reserve discount rate, which I didn't get into tonight, but hopefully will next time. And that sharply cut back on the increase in the quantity of money. The Federal Reserve had monetary growth targets sharply lower than they had been. They deliberately reduced the rate of increase in the quantity of money. And this provoked a temporary major recession. In 1982, the unemployment rate temporarily got above 11%. But following that, the rate of price increases dramatically fell. Wage demands dramatically declined. It was common for a while for people to be getting 8, 10, 12% salary increases each year. But when the growth in money sharply declined, the growth in spending sharply declined, the economy could not support this sort of price increase any longer. For a while it went on, but it resulted in major unemployment. And then the unions greatly relaxed their demands. They had the phenomenon of givebacks. They had contracts entitling them to wage increases equal to the rise in prices. They didn't insist on getting that. Because had they, then they would have caused more business failures and unemployment. So they gave that back. And wage increases then sharply moderated. The rise in cost and prices greatly moderated. And then the unemployment rate sharply fell. Okay, I think we covered a lot of ground. I hope you found this enlightening. I always think it's enlightening. And then I learned that many, many people, it doesn't register at all. Okay, see you all next week. Have a good week.